We want to take a peek at the Sermon on the Mount. We want to find out our spiritual quotient. We want to see what our SQ is tonight. We're told that in these Beatitudes, if we can be poor in spirit, if we mourn, if we're pure at heart, if we're merciful, spiritually righteous, and so on, we will attain the kingdom of heaven. And yet, the very words that tell us we will attain the kingdom of heaven are really very strange. They're even strange now, and at the time they were uttered, why, it was like a completely different language. Poor in spirit. How strange. Why, even the word spirit itself was a strange word. And then, blessed are they that mourn. How could they be blessed? And so on. Now, in order to appreciate the deeper meanings that were given us there, suppose we review a little bit about the life of Jesus and see that he had brought a teaching which was very revolutionary. So revolutionary that it was he, a rabbi in a Jewish temple, who turned against his own people and said to the Pharisees, "That God that you worship, that Father that you call God, whom you say invented death to punish those who were born in sin, I know of no such God. That Father who rewards and punishes, that's not God. That Father who says all men were born in iniquity, that's not God." As a matter of fact, he said to them, "You don't worship God at all. You're worshiping the devil." Here he comes to the most rigidly righteous of all the sects who consider themselves divine individuals endowed by God with certain inalienable rights that are not due to anyone else. They who have said that unless you join the ranks of Judaism, why, you're going straight to hell. It's the only way you can atone for the sin of Adam. And that was their belief. And here comes this upstart to say to them, "That's not God, that's the devil." And so there's the first blasphemy. And now they see that they have a mortal enemy on their hands. "What do you know about God anyway?" "Oh," he says, "I ought to know something about God. I'm the Son of God." There's the second blasphemy. "He is the Son of God," not they, he. So now they know they've got to liquidate him. But the strange thing that happens is that even though he's called a madman possessed of the devil himself, he isn't like John the Baptist. John the Baptist, he just went around yelling, "Repent." That you could take. But this madman, he goes out and proves what he says. He says something about a God who loves. And then he shows this God loving, and a cripple gets up and walks. He has no visible food supply, and he feeds multitudes. What are you going to do with such a man? Why, the people are certainly going to believe that man. They're going to think that what he's doing is real. He's going to wean them away from Judaism. And then of all things, he gets in front of a tomb and he raises a dead man. Now they know he's possessed of demons. That settles it. He's got to go. Strange thing is, that's exactly what he wants to do. He plans to go. Crucifixion is on his agenda. He's going to meet death head on. He's going to show them that death is just another false concept of man. He walks right through death. He reappears. And now his disciples, frustrated, embittered, disillusioned, are rallied together again. The man they had pinned their hopes on has defeated death. Now then, in the course of his life, he showed us miracles. He said they weren't miracles. We insisted they were. He said, "The Father within doeth these things, not I." But he said then a greater thing than even that. "If you believe on the works that I do, these works you will do, and greater ones." Greater works will you do. Now, what could we ever do greater than resurrecting a little 12-year-old girl or the son of a widow at Nain? Or resurrecting Lazarus, or ourselves, walking into death, being buried in a tomb, and then stepping out, as promised, on schedule, 3 days later. And yet he says to us, "Greater works would ye do." And he says, "I'm going to show you how, besides. I've left you a legacy. Study it. Study it very carefully. It's a new way of life." And so man has studied it very carefully. And man calls it the Sermon on the Mount. It's a summation of those things which he did, but also how he did them, and how we can follow in his footsteps. Now, obviously, we haven't learned very much from that Sermon on the Mount. We certainly aren't following in his footsteps until we came into this metaphysical work and then the mystical end of it. A little cold was enough to make us run to bed. We have war. Well, there's no sense going into the catastrophes we face in this world today. It is certain that no one, no nation, has learned the secret of the sermon or of the life of Jesus. Not even India, as attested by their black holes of Calcutta and the famines and so on. But still, "If ye believe on me, the works that I do, greater works shall ye do." From the man who did the works, from he who said, "I am the Son of God, but I go to your Father and my Father," we are brethren. Surely such a man did not give us empty words. Surely within those words is embodied the very essence of our own being and the way to attain that which he said we could. And so we're going to look at those words. And we must know this. You think you have a choice. Man has thought he had a choice. And so he has either accepted or ignored those words. But we don't have a choice. These are not just little commandments laid down like something for the Optimist Club or Rotary. This is the law of God. You either accept it and live by it, or by not accepting it and not living by it, you violate it. You have that privilege. And as you violate it, which the world has done to this moment, you incur the punishment, not from God, but that penalty which is inherent in your violation. Knock your knee against the wall and God doesn't punish you, but it hurts. In other words, the law of cause and effect is here in this scriptural law, and inasmuch as most of us are unaware of the meaning of the law, you may be sure that every moment of our lives is spent in violation of it. And so you can look around at things that you would think had no relationship to this law: epidemics, disasters, famine, poverty, earthquakes. But be sure of this, they are very much related to this teaching, as is disease, germs, contagion, infection, and death itself. There's nothing in this world that is not related to this teaching, and there are no exceptions. And so we start this little pilgrimage here this evening, but we're not going directly into the Beatitudes. We must first see why these Beatitudes have been mutilated, adulterated, misinterpreted. And so for that reason, here are some translations. Now, many of these translations are prepared with the idea of introducing those who have found it difficult to read the Bible to something easy to read. And they succeed because it's very easy to read. And while being easy to read, it also says nothing about the message of Jesus. That's why it's so easy to read. For example, when Jesus saw the vast crowds, he went up the hillside. And after he had sat down, his disciples came to him. Now, this is the reading here for "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Then he began his teaching by saying, "How happy are the humble-minded, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs." Now, poor in spirit and humble-minded are as different as Africa from Alameda. But this is making it easy for you. You see, you can read this and understand it because they're nice, good English words. And I might say it goes on like that. The next one is a great scholar. And after his name, you find many degrees. So many, you can't fit them on one page. He has made a brilliant translation of the Bible. And it goes something like this. "Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he ascended the hillside. And when he had sat down, his disciples gathered around him, and he began to teach them." Now then, he doesn't like the word blessed. It just doesn't ring with him. So we say, how fortunate are the oppressed in spirit. The oppressed in spirit. How fortunate. Then, how fortunate are those who grieve. How fortunate are the gentle. The gentle instead of the meek. And so on. And as you see as we go along, when you take a key word and you bring it down to make it sweet and simple, you're not helping anybody. You're putting a veil over truth. I forgot this other fellow. Here's what he says about something. Instead of "how blessed," he uses the word "how happy." How happy are the humble-minded. How happy, how... You get the point. Now then, we're using the King James, and this doesn't mean that other versions are not adequate. They certainly are. But you must be careful when you pick one of these easy reading jobs that you don't go away thinking you know the Bible and then wonder why that which you know doesn't seem to have any effect on your life. Now, you've got a good speed, or you've got a... Oh, you can just name them. There are at least 10 good ones. But you must be careful that you're not getting these simplified versions. They're overly simplified. Seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him. Now, it's rather surprising, but some interpretations of the Sermon on the Mount pass over that very quickly and go right into the Beatitudes. And that changing of the word to hillside is one of the reasons. Now, this is very important at this point to see what is happening. Jesus is saying to his disciples, I'm not ready to talk to you yet. I'm going into a silence, the same as you and I did before this meeting started. Going into a silence, seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain. I know it's called the Sermon on the Mount, but that mountain is a mountain of silence. And so you can see him there meditating. Why? Well, he never said anything of his own. God spoke through him. And the words that are going to come forth are not the words of Jesus at all. They're the words of the Father. And in order to receive the words of the Father, he must go into the silence, even as you and I. He went up to a mountain. And when he was set, his disciples came unto him. They let him get up into this high consciousness, and then they came. Now he was ready to give them the Word of God. He was living by his own credo. Not by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. And then we're given thereby the source of the Sermon on the Mount. The channel, the instrument was Jesus. The words, the thoughts, the ideas were the Father. Can we ignore those words? Must we not go into them, study them, distill them, come up with the meanings that apply to our daily life? Perhaps every day, too. And when he was set, they came unto him. He opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now let's turn it around and see what he did say as well. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, not the rich in spirit. And he didn't say, Blessed are the rich in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And no one else. The first question is, are you poor in spirit? We're all seeking that heavenly consciousness. We're seeking that fourth dimension of understanding called heaven. We know by now it's not a place. We know it's a state of consciousness, the highest state man can attain on earth, which he called heaven. And we're trying to raise ourselves from Son of Man to Son of God, earth consciousness to heavenly consciousness on earth. And here he's telling us, Blessed are the poor in spirit. When he said it, the word spirit was new. It had been freshly minted. What was it? The disciples had no idea. Spirit. Whatever could that be? And yet here it is, the first beatitude, the very cornerstone of everything that is to follow. What is spirit? Well, Jesus told us God is spirit. Well, then was he saying, Blessed are the poor in God? As a matter of fact, he was. But why did he say the poor in spirit if spirit and God meant the same? And therein is the reason for the choice of the word spirit. Let's look at John. I think John gives us a clue. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now suppose we take spirit and put it where the Word is. In the beginning was the Spirit, and the Spirit was with God, and the Spirit was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. God, Spirit. In the Spirit was life, and the life was the light of men. All things were made of Spirit, and without Spirit was not anything made that was made. Spirit is being revealed here as the substance of life. The substance of life. You say, well, where is it? The disciples certainly didn't know where it was. They were men of flesh and blood. Where is this Spirit? But wait a minute. Wait a minute. This man of flesh and blood was crucified, wasn't he? This man of flesh and blood, after being crucified, stepped forth again. How could he? Because he was made of that Spirit. It was that Spirit which could not be crucified. It was that Spirit that stepped forth after crucifixion, after the tomb, in resurrection, appearing again as the flesh and blood. And it was that Spirit that walked through the hills of Galilee, looking as a man of flesh and blood. It was that Spirit that performed the miracles. It was that Spirit that could say to Pilate, "Thou couldst have no power over me." It was that Spirit in Gethsemane that could say, "Peter, put back that sword. We don't need it." Why? Because Spirit is indestructible. But he said, "I go to my Father and your Father." And so you see, he is revealing for the first time in this civilized world that man is that substance called Spirit, and not flesh and blood. Yes, that's what he was revealing. Blessed are the poor in spirit. This indestructible substance is the very substance of God, and of this substance God makes his creation. All kingdoms, vegetable, animal, mineral, human. Spirit is the substance of them. The earth is the Lord's. And the Spirit of the Lord is the substance of the earth and the fullness thereof. We must learn more about that Spirit which is our substance. We must learn, for example, that it is infinite. It has no limitation and no limit. We must learn that it is invisible. You can't see it, touch it, taste it, smell it, hear it, not with your outer senses. We must learn that this invisible and infinite substance is the very substance of all life in God's creation, and is the very substance of God itself. And then as we learn that is the nature of our being, and that in that Spirit is embodied the fullness of God, Son, all that I have is thine, we say, then why should I be poor in this substance? Why poor? Why not rich? Because Jesus had learned a secret, that's why. He had learned that by being poor in spirit, he was rich. And by being rich, you would be poor. He had learned that spirit had to flow. You couldn't hold on to it. It would become stagnant. if you let the Spirit of God well up within you without letting it flow out, it's like a river with no outlet. He learned why giving was the very thing that caused receiving. If you gave the Spirit out, you had an empty cup, a vessel unfilled. And the minute you gave out this Spirit, lo and behold, it was filled again. The more you gave out, the more came in. And so he gave us a secret. Don't hoard it. Don't cling to it. Don't try to possess it. It can't be done. If you do, you will use up this Spirit, and you won't be refilled. You won't be regenerated. Let it flow. And why do you let it flow, beside the fact that it must flow? Because life is an evolution in spirit. It must continue to ascend. It can only ascend with the inflow of this substance called spirit. The continuous flowing from God through the Son becomes life, activity, law, being, consciousness. Let it flow uninterruptedly, he says. Keep your vessel empty. Create a vacuum, and let the Father within fill your cup. Be poor eternally. Some poets call it a state of divine discontent. Let the Spirit flow endlessly, continuously into many mansions. There's no end, and there cannot be, because if there is an end, you do not attain the kingdom of heaven. The attainment of that level called the fourth dimensional consciousness is only through the continuous unfoldment of that Spirit within. Now we're listening to the man who says to a leper, "Here, I don't mind touching you. There's no contagion there." We're listening to the man who says to a blind man, "Open your eyes." Why? Because he had learned the secret of letting the Spirit of God continue to flow through him with no interruption. How often did he retire into the silence, as he did at the beginning of this very sermon? 40 days in the wilderness. Think of the many hours and hours and hours that he was in silent communion with God. And now he gives us his great secret. "I have learned that because I am poor in spirit, seeking the Father constantly, unceasingly, that the Father flows through me unceasingly, and that Spirit which flows through me can heal anyone who walks into my consciousness." And then he says, "Why don't you try it? Why don't you wake, thou that sleepest? Because when you do, this Spirit in you will remove a cancer. This Spirit in you will take care of arthritis. This Spirit in you will remove any imperfection on the face of the universe. Why doesn't medical science find out about this Spirit? Why doesn't psychology and psychiatry find out about this Spirit? Why doesn't religion find out about it? Why doesn't education find out about it? Is it to be ignored? Here is the Spirit of God in every man on the face of the earth, and the man himself is unaware. He walks in his little island, apart, trying to solve the riddle of life, when the very life that he cannot understand is within him bubbling to be let out. the imprisoned splendor that Browning talked about is that spirit we're told to be poor in, eternally poor to be eternally rich. Let's look at the word is. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. There's nothing in the future tense there. There's nothing about it shall be, it will be. It says that when you're poor in spirit, you are feasting on manna from heaven. Now, of course, as you can see, this is going to be the foundation of your work. He has revealed to us that the universe we have looked at day in and day out is not what we have thought it to be. He is revealing that this is a spiritual universe, and that we are spiritual individuals, and that there is a substance unknown to the scientist, the philosopher, the theologian, the educator. There is a substance. You won't find it by cutting a man open with a saw, but this substance can never die. It can walk through a crucifixion and walk out again. It can walk through a fire and walk out again. It can walk through a flood. And no one on earth has power over this substance. No one. You can drop an atom bomb in the middle of it. You can shoot a machine gun at it. But always the spirit will walk free. It is eternal, indestructible, and infinite. And it is the substance of the universe in which we live. That's his revelation. And those who refuse to ignore it any longer, who begin to live with that realization, find that it happens to be the truth. That spirit released is the only power on the face of the earth. There's not even a power to oppose it. It's all in a class by itself. And in that spirit is a mind that is infinite, called the mind of God. And that mind, in that spirit, is the creator of the universe. And in that mind, in that spirit, you and I are. As it flows through us, as we are consciously aware of that divine inflow, we find a new harmony in our life. We find that heaven isn't as far away as people had supposed. It's not a bit of mythology. It's not a hereafter. We find that the Pharisees really didn't know anything about God. We find that heaven is here now. We begin to sense the meaning of, to know the Spirit, to know God aright is life eternal. And all we have done so far is go to the first beatitude. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And we have learned now, to sum it up, that spirit is the divine substance that man has called God. You can't go anywhere without walking through it, because that's all there is. It's all over, everywhere. All of time and space is within it. The universe is within it and is formed of it. And the secret of spirit is, let it flow. Spirit even becomes your teacher. The teacher within. Now, we won't try to grasp the magnitude of that revelation in one moment. But now he goes on to, blessed are they that mourn, they shall be comforted. I think maybe we'll have a little rest. But think of this, blessed are they that mourn, they shall be comforted. And remember that in every person's life on the face of the earth, there has come at least one time of mourning. So he's talking to every one of us. He's telling us that though we mourn, we are blessed, and we shall be comforted. And remember, this isn't a stranger talking. This is he who walked through death and emerged living. This is he who is the instrument for the voice of God, telling us, blessed are they that mourn, they shall be comforted. Not casually, but a great revelation of immortality. And we'll discuss that in a moment. Let's consider this, blessed are they that mourn. It can be taken at least two ways, and they're both valid. The first way is individually as a realization that I, as a human being, am really among those whom Jesus classified as the living dead. Now that I know my name is spirit and not flesh and blood, why, this flesh and blood has to die. And so I'm going to mourn. In other words, this mourning is the awakening that I've been dead all this time and didn't know it. And so I'm mourning for myself. This is one way. I consider that just a facet of the fuller meaning. The fuller meaning being that to be in mourning for someone who you think has passed on, there's nothing in the world that could comfort you at all except the realization that the one who passed on didn't pass out, but just passed on and up. In short, Jesus is telling us here that the spiritual universe is indestructible. Man is spirit, and there's no such thing as mortality. He's revealing the nature of the illusion of death. That physical death is not death at all. For spirit is eternal, and therefore those who have mourned a physical death ultimately will know and learn that not only did not the person they thought die, but neither can they. And that's about the only thing that can comfort one who is mourning. So his second principle is that you're not a mortal being, you're immortal. The first one was, we live in a spiritual universe. And if you're seeing it with material eyes, you're committing yourself to this next thing, this death. But if you're learning to open up to the spirit within and lay down that personal sense, you will find that the kingdom of heaven begins to unfold, and then you will be comforted by the Comforter, by the Christ spirit within. Now, we are here in the 20th century. Think how revolutionary these things were at the time they were said. And you know the disciples would listen and listen and listen. But this was a completely new vocabulary to them. You remember when he told them, I go, if I go away, if I go not away, the Comforter will not come unto you. Comforter, whatever was that? And so let's see that if we ever are capable of mourning for the death of someone, that we are violating spiritual law. We're turning our back on the very words of the Creator, who says, "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted." In other words, stop the mourning. Stop looking at death as if it were a reality. Begin to see spirit. Develop your spiritual consciousness. And so that's our direction now. We're passing the point where John or Mary or Jim dying is going to make a great big dent, and where we're going to go off and grieve. And of course, you can still do it. But remember, in that violation of your spiritual universe, you are violating the truth of God, which says that God is light and in Him there is no darkness at all. The moment you accept death as reality, you're living in a different place than the spiritual universe, and don't expect the laws of the spiritual universe to govern you. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And we have to see meekness now in its great meaning here. The world's idea of a meek man is a sort of a quiet, unassuming, sort of a weakling, you might say. A fellow you can push around. But meekness here is used in quite a different sense. You remember that Saul, well, nobody ever accused him of being meek. He was out killing, persecuting. But the moment he learned the meaning of meekness, the power of it, he turned right around to being very meek, and with that meekness he developed 7 churches. Jesus was very meek. So meek that he overcame death. And the meekness they're telling us about is that state of receptivity to this spirit within, in which we lay down this me very meekly and become obedient unto the power of the Father within. In our meekness, we find our strength. And so meekness now becomes that state of listening, that receptivity, that obedience. And it's this very meekness which is going to lead to our illumination. It's the weakness, the meekness that says, "Father, thy will be done." It's the meekness that can look at death and smile. It's the meekness that can look at disease and smile. Why? Because we're being meek unto the Father's truth, which says, "In my kingdom there is neither death nor disease." That meekness which rejects the world of appearances because it is obedient unto the law of God. We wonder, how does that inherit the earth? We thought the conqueror inherits the earth. But we find that the mailed fist of the conqueror is closing around nothing. In the material sense, the earth is what he's capturing. But let us not forget, the earth is the Lord's. and he isn't capturing anything that belongs to God, he's capturing nothingness. It is only through our spiritual consciousness that we begin to see the earth as it is. And then we find that we overcome the illusions that the conqueror has had about the earth that he has captured. We find that the fetters fall away. We find that the fullness of the earth is revealed unto us as spiritual reality, as heaven itself. And while the might, the power, the sword is conquering its physical sense of things, playing with the shadows that have no substance, we are delivered the earth and all its treasures. And that is our inheritance. The promised land, the reality of being, truth, where there is no disease and death, where there is no crime and corruption, where there is no lack and limitation, where there is no famine and poverty. On the physical earth of the conqueror, these things are. In the spiritual earth of the meek, there is only the kingdom of heaven. And this becomes God's dowry unto his sons.